Well, the first day we were here, about 10 days ago, I was exploring and was in the store, in the bookstore, and I was quite surprised to see this book called Three Men in a Boat, because I don't see this book around very much. How many of you have ever heard of it before? Well, you see, it's not a well-known book, and I was surprised and wondered why in this fairly small bookstore we would have this. And then I was browsing in the library and found it there as well. So I asked Mary Schramm if she was a fan of this writer, and she said no. She wasn't quite sure who had ordered this for the bookstore, but there they were. And she said, not many people buy that book. I said, well, that's a shame. And see if we couldn't do something about it. I'll tell you, that I hadn't heard of this book either until 7 years ago. Our family was living in England, in a little village on the Thames near Oxford. And I had just bought a guidebook because I was planning to have us take lots of little day trips around the countryside. And in the guidebook I had, it kept running across phrases like, "This is the little inn named in Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat," or "This is the town described in chapter 14 of Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat." And I had never heard of this and decided I better get a hold of it. So I bought it, read it, and I haven't ever enjoyed a book as much as I've enjoyed this. And I've loaned my copy to other people, and they've told me they liked it just as well. So I thought you might enjoy it, too. Jerome K. Jerome, very odd name, was born in England in 1859, and this book was published in 1889. So it's right in the middle of that somber, dour Victorian period when we weren't sure there was very much humor. Queen Victoria, famous for her phrase, "We are not amused." But I think she must have been if she read this. The book was intended to be a travelogue. And the writer included so much subtle humor in it that the editors cut out most of the travelogue stuff and left in all the humor. So we're blessed with that. Maybe one of the reasons that I have an affinity to Jerome K. Jerome is his middle name was Jerome, it's Kramka, I think it is. And his father's name was Jerome Klapka, and his father's name was Jerome Clap Jerome, whose son is Jerome Klapka Jerome. And in order to keep them straight, the father called the son Luther. Well, the story is about three idle young Englishmen who decide that they need to take a trip. And I'm going to start right at chapter 1, which gives a little explanation about why they want to take the trip. "There were four of us, George and William Samuel Harris and myself and Montmorency," that's the dog. "We were sitting in my room smoking and talking about how bad we were, bad from a medical point of view, I mean, of course. We were all feeling seedy and we were getting quite nervous about it. Harris said he felt such extraordinary fits of giddiness come over him at times that he hardly knew what he was doing. And then George said that he had fits of giddiness too, and hardly knew what he was doing. With me, it was my liver that was out of order. I knew it was my liver that was out of order because I had just been reading a patent liver pill circular in which were detailed the various symptoms by which a man could tell when his liver was out of order. I had them all. It is a most extraordinary thing, but I never read a patent medicine advertisement without being impelled to the conclusion that I am suffering from the particular disease therein dealt with in its most virulent form. The diagnosis seems in every case to correspond exactly with all the sensations I have ever felt. I remember going to the British Museum one day to read up the treatment for some slight ailment of which I had a touch. Hay fever, I fancy it was. I got down the book and read all I came to read, and then, in an unthinking moment, I idly turned the leaves and began to indolently study diseases generally. I forget which was the first distemper I plunged into, some fearful, devastating scourge, I know, and before I had glanced half down the list of, quote, premonitory symptoms, unquote, it was borne in upon me that I had fairly got it. I sat for a while frozen with horror, and then in the listlessness of despair, I again turned over the pages. I came to typhoid fever, read the symptoms, discovered that I had typhoid fever. Must have had it for months without knowing it. Wondered what else I had got. Turned up St. Vitus dance. Found, as I expected, that I had that too. Began to get interested in my case and determined to sift it to the bottom, and so started alphabetically. Read up ague and learned that I was sickening for it and that the acute stage would commence in about another fortnight. Bright's disease, I was relieved to find, I had only in a modified form, and so far as that was concerned, I might live for years. Cholera, I had, with severe complications, and diphtheria, I seem to have been born with. I plotted conscientiously through the 26 letters, and the only malady I could conclude I had not got was housemaid's knee. I felt rather hurt about this at first. It seemed somehow to be a sort of slight. Why hadn't I got housemaid's knee? Why this invidious reservation? After a while, however, less grasping feelings prevailed. I reflected that I had every other known malady in the pharmacology, and I grew less selfish and determined to do without housemaid's knee. Gout, in its most malignant stage, it would appear, had seized me without my being aware of it, and zimosis I had evidently been suffering with from boyhood. There were no more diseases after zimosis, so I concluded there was nothing else the matter with me. I sat and pondered. I thought what an interesting case I must be from a medical point of view. What an acquisition I should be to a class. Students would have no need to walk the hospitals if they had me. I was a hospital in myself. All they needed would be to walk around me and after that take their diploma. Then I wondered how long I had to live. I tried to examine myself. I felt my pulse. I could not at first feel any pulse at all. Then all of a sudden it seemed to start off. I pulled out my watch and timed it. I made it 147 to the minute. I tried to feel my heart. I could not feel my heart. It had stopped beating. I have since been induced to come to the opinion that it must have been there all the time and must have been beating, but I cannot account for it. I patted myself all over my front, from what I call my waist, up to my head. And I went a bit round each side and a little way up the back. But I could not feel or hear anything. I tried to look at my tongue. I stuck it out as far as ever it would go. And I shut one eye and tried to examine it with the other. I could only see the tip. And the only thing that I could gain from that was to feel more certain than before that I had scarlet fever. I had walked into that reading room a happy, healthy man. I crawled out a decrepit wreck. I went to my medical man. He is an old chum of mine and feels my pulse and looks at my tongue and talks about the weather all for nothing when I fancy I'm ill. So I thought I would do him a good turn by going to him now. What a doctor wants, I said, is practice. He shall have me. He will get more practice out of me than out of 1,700 of your ordinary commonplace patients with only one or two diseases each. So I went straight up and saw him, and he said, well, what's the matter with you? I said, I will not take up your time, dear boy, with telling you what is the matter with me. Life is brief, and you might pass away before I had finished. But I will tell you what is not the matter with me. I have not got housemaid's knee. Why I have not got housemaid's knee, I cannot tell you. But the fact remains that I have not got it. Everything else, however, I have got. And I told him how I came to discover it all. Then he opened me and looked down me and clutched hold of my wrist, and then he hit me over the chest when I wasn't expecting it. A cowardly thing to do, I call it. And immediately afterwards butted me with the side of his head. After that, he sat down and wrote out a prescription and folded it up and gave it me and put it in my pocket and went out. I did not open it. I took it to the nearest chemist's, that's the nearest drugstore, and handed it in. The man read it and then handed it back. He said he didn't keep it. I said, you are a chemist, meaning you're a druggist? He said, I am a chemist. If I was a cooperative stores and family hotel combined, I might be able to oblige you. Being only a chemist hampers me. I read the prescription. It read this: 1 pound of beefsteak with 1 pint of bitter beer every 6 hours. 1 10-mile walk every morning. To bed at 11 sharp every night. And don't stuff up your head with things you don't understand. Okay, now I'll skip over a part of just a brief section. Then these three are trying to decide what sort of a trip they'll take for their good health. And one of them says, Harris says, no, if you want rest and change, you can't beat a sea trip. I objected to the sea trip strongly. The sea trip does you good when you're going to have a couple of months of it, but for a week it is wicked. You start on Monday with the idea implanted in your bosom that you are going to enjoy yourself. You wave an airy adieu to the boys on shore, light your biggest pipe, and swagger about the deck as if you were Captain Cook, Sir Francis Drake, and Christopher Columbus all rolled into one. On Tuesday, you wish you hadn't come. On Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, you wish you were dead. On Saturday, you are able to swallow a little beef tea and to sit up on deck and answer with a wan, sweet smile when kind-hearted people ask you how you feel now. On Sunday, you begin to walk about again and take solid food. And on Monday morning, as with your bag and umbrella in your hand, you stand by the gunwale waiting to step ashore, you begin to thoroughly like it. Now I'm going to read in chapter 2 a little section about camping out, because many of us are camping out these days around here. And he begins chapter 2 talking about what it's going to be like out there camping amongst nature. And he goes into just the most romantic kind of description of life out in the wild. So I'll just read a little bit of it so you can get the tone. He's talking about what it is as you're sitting by the margin of the shore of a lake, having pitched your tent. We laugh and rising knock the ashes from our burnt out pipes and say good night And lulled by the lapping water and the rustling trees, we fall asleep beneath the great still stars and dream that the world is young again, young and sweet as she used to be ere the centuries of fret and care had furrowed her fair face, ere her children's sins and follies made old her loving heart, sweet as she was in those bygone days when, a new-made mother, she nursed us, her children, upon her own deep breast, ere the wiles of painted civilization had lured us away from her fond arms, and the poisoned sneers of artificiality had made us ashamed of the simple life we led with her, in the simple, stately home where mankind was born so many thousands of years ago. Harris said, "How about when it rained?" You can never rouse Harris. There is no poetry about Harris, no wild yearning for the unattainable. Harris never weeps, he knows not why. If Harris's eyes fill with tears, you can bet it is because Harris has been eating raw onions or has put too much Worcester over his chop. If you were to stand at night by the seashore with Harris and say, "Hark, do you not hear? Is it but the mermaids singing deep below the waving waters, or sad spirits chanting dirges for white corpses held by seaweed?" Harris would take you by the arm and say, "I know what it is, old man, you've got a chill. Now you come along with me. I know a place round the corner here where you can get a drop of the finest Scotch whiskey you ever tasted. Put you right in less than no time." Harris always does know a place round the corner where you can get something brilliant in the drinking line. I believe that if you met Harris up in Paradise, supposing such a thing likely, he would immediately greet you with, "So glad you've come, old fellow. I've found a nice place round the corner here where you can get some really first-class nectar." In the present instance, however, as regarded the camping out, his practical view of the matter came as a very timely hint. Camping out in rainy weather is not pleasant. It is evening. You are wet through, and there is a good 2 inches of water in the boat, and all the things are damp. You find a place on the banks that is not quite so puddly as the other places you have seen, and you land and lug out the tent, and two of you proceed to fix it. It is soaked and heavy, and it flops about and tumbles down on you and clings around your head and makes you mad. The rain is pouring steadily down all the time. It is difficult enough to fix a tent in dry weather. In wet, the task becomes Herculean. Instead of helping you, it seems that the other man is simply playing the fool. Just as you get your side beautifully fixed, he gives it a hoist from his end and spoils it all. "Here, what are you up to?" you call out. "What are you up to?" he retorts. "Let go, can't you? Don't pull it. You've got it all wrong, you stupid ass," you shout. "No, I haven't," he yells back. "Let go your side." "I tell you, you've got it all wrong," you roar, wishing that you could get at him. And you give your ropes a lug that pulls all of his pegs out. "Ah, the idiot," you hear him mutter to himself. And then comes a savage haul, and away goes your side. You lay down the mallet and start to go around and tell him what you think about the whole business. And at the same time, he starts around in the same direction to come and explain his views to you. And you follow each other around and around, swearing at one another, until the tent tumbles down in a heap and leaves you looking at each other across its ruins. And then you both indignantly exclaim in the same breath, "There you are, what did I tell you?" Meanwhile, the third man, who's been bailing out the boat and who has spilled the water down his sleeve and has been cursing away to himself steadily for the last 10 minutes, wants to know what the thundering blazes you're playing at and why the tent isn't up yet. At last, somehow or other, it does get up and you land the things. It is hopeless attempting to make a wood fire, so you light the methylated spirit stove and crowd around that. Rainwater is the chief article of diet at supper. The bread is 2/3 rainwater. The beefsteak pie is exceedingly rich in it. And the jam and the butter and the salt and the coffee have all combined with it to make soup. After supper, you find your tobacco is damp and you cannot smoke. Luckily, you have a bottle of the stuff that cheers and inebriates if taken in proper quantity, and this restores to you sufficient interest in life to induce you to go to bed. There you dream that an elephant has suddenly sat down on your chest and that the volcano has exploded and thrown you down to the bottom of the sea, the elephant still sleeping peacefully on your bosom. You wake up and grasp the idea that something terrible really has happened. Your first impression is that the end of the world has come, and then you think that this cannot be, and that it is thieves and murderers, or else fire. And this opinion you express in the usual method. No help comes, however, and all you know is that thousands of people are kicking you, and you are being smothered. Somebody else seems in trouble, too. You can hear his faint cries coming from underneath your bed. Determining at all events to sell your life dearly, you struggle frantically, hitting out right and left with arms and legs, yelling lustily the while, and at last something gives way, and you find your head in the fresh air. 2 feet off, you dimly observe a half-dressed ruffian waiting to kill you, and you are preparing for a life-and-death struggle with him when it begins to dawn upon you that it's Jim. "Oh, it's you, is it?" he says, recognizing you at the same moment. "Yes," you answer, rubbing your eyes. "What's happened?" "The tent's blown down, I think," he says. "Where's Bill?" Then you both raise up your voices and shout for Bill. And the ground beneath you heaves and rocks, and the muffled voice that you heard before replies from out of the room, "Get off my head, can't you?" And Bill struggles out, a muddy, trampled wreck, and in an unnecessarily aggressive mood, he being under the evident belief that the whole thing has been done on purpose. Well, some of us have had similar kinds of tenting experiences. Okay, I'm going to read one more section and then let Karen read a section or two. This one, and you notice what happens is that whenever the narrator starts telling about some particular detail, immediately there are digressions. And digressions upon digressions. And it takes a whole chapter for them to progress just a few yards up the Thames River on their boat. But now here we're to chapter 3, and they're still deciding what to take along on the trip. And Harris agrees to make out a list. That's Harris all over. So ready to take the burden of everything himself and put it on the backs of other people. He always reminds me of my poor Uncle Podger. You never saw such a commotion up and down a house in all your life as when my Uncle Podger undertook to do a job. A picture would have come home from the frame makers and be standing in the dining room waiting to be put up. And Aunt Podger would ask what was to be done with it. And Uncle Podger would say, "Oh, you leave that to me. Don't you any of you worry yourselves about that. I'll do all of that." And then he would take off his coat and begin. He would send the girl out for 6 pennyworth of nail, and then one of the boys after her to tell her what size to get, and from that he would gradually work down and start the whole house. "Now you go and get me my hammer, Will," he would shout, "and you bring me the rule, Tom. And I shall want the stepladder, and I should had better have a kitchen chair, too. And Jim, you run around to Mr. Goggles and tell him Pa's kind regards and hopes his leg's better, and will he lend him his level? And don't you go, Maria, because I shall want somebody to hold me the light. And when the girl comes back, she must go out again for a bit of picture cord. And Tom, where's Tom? Tom, you come here. I shall want you to hand me up the picture." And then he would lift up the picture and drop it. And it would come out of the frame. And he would try to save the glass and cut himself. And then he would spring around the room looking for his handkerchief. He could not find his handkerchief. because it was in the pocket of the coat he had taken off. And he did not know where he had put the coat. And all the house had to leave off looking for his tools and start looking for his coat. And he would dance around and hinder them. "Doesn't anybody in the whole house know where my coat is? I never came across such a set in all my life. Upon my word, I didn't. Six of you, and you can't find a coat that I put down not 5 minutes ago." Well, of all the... And then he'd get up and find out that he'd been sitting on it. And he would call out, "Oh, you can give it up. I've found it myself now. Might just as well ask the cat to find anything as expect you people to find it." And when half an hour had been spent in tying up his finger, and a new glass had been got, and the tools and the ladder and the chair and the candle had been brought, he would have another go, the whole family, including the girl, and the charwoman, standing around in a semicircle, ready to help. Two people would have to hold the chair, and a third would help him up upon it and hold him there, and a fourth would hand him a nail, and a fifth would pass him up the hammer, and he would take a hold of the nail and drop it. Sounds like one of these Norwegian jokes, doesn't it? "There," he would say in an injured tone, "now the nail's gone." And we would all have to go down on our knees and grovel for it, while he would stand on the chair and grunt and want to know if he was to be kept there all the evening. The nail would be found at last, but by that time he would have lost the hammer. "Where's the hammer? What did I do with the hammer? Great heavens! Seven of you gaping around there, and you don't know what I did with the hammer." We would find the hammer for him, and then he would have lost sight of the mark he had made on the wall, where the nail was to go in. And each of us had to get up on the chair beside him and see if we could find it. And we would each discover it in a different place. And he would call us all fools, one after another, and tell us to get down. And he would take the rule and remeasure and find that he wanted half of 31 3/8 inches from the corner, and would try to do it in his head and go mad. And we would all try to do it in our heads and all arrive at different results and sneer at one another. And in the general row, the original number would be forgotten, and Uncle Podger would have to measure it again. He would use a bit of string this time, and at the critical moment, when the old fool was leaning over the chair at an angle of 45 and trying to reach a point 3 inches beyond what was possible for him to reach, the string would slip, and down he would slide onto the piano, a really fine musical effect being produced by the suddenness with which his head and body struck all the notes at the same time. And Aunt Maria would say that she would not allow the children to stand around and hear such language. At last, Uncle Podger would get his spot fixed again and put the point of the nail on it with his left hand and take the hammer in his right hand. And with the first blow, he would smash his thumb and drop the hammer with a yell on somebody's toes. Aunt Maria would mildly observe that next time Uncle Podger was going to hammer a nail into the wall, she hoped he'd let her know in time so that she could make arrangements to go and spend a week with her mother while it was being done. "Oh, you women, you make such a fuss over everything, Uncle Podger." Uncle Podger would reply, picking himself up, "Why, I like doing a little job of this sort." And then he would have another try, and at the second blow, the nail would go clean through the plaster and half the hammer after it. And Uncle Podger be precipitated against the wall with force nearly sufficient to flatten his nose. Then we had to find the rule and the string again, and a new hole was made. And about midnight, the picture would be up. Very crooked and insecure, the wall for yards round looking as if it had been smoothed down with a rake, and everybody dead beat and wretched, except Uncle Podger. "There you are," he would say, stepping heavily off the chair onto the charwoman's corns. And surveying the mess he had made with evident pride. Why, some people would have had a man in to do a little thing like that. Well, that's the end of the little... That was just to explain what Harris was like. Okay. Another of our favorite sections is section about what kind of food they decide to bring along. For other breakfast things, George suggested eggs and bacon, which were easy to cook, cold meat, tea, bread and butter, and jam. For lunch, he said we could have biscuits, cold meat, bread and butter, and jam, but no cheese. Cheese makes too much of itself. It wants the whole boat to itself. It goes through the hamper and gives a cheesy flavor to everything else there. You can't tell whether you're eating apple pie or German sausage or strawberries and cream. It all seems like cheese. There's too much odor about cheese. I remember a friend of mine buying a couple of cheeses at Liverpool. Splendid cheeses they were, ripe and mellow, and with 200 horsepower scent about them that might have been warranted to carry 3 miles and knock a man over at 200 yards. I was in Liverpool at the time, and my friend said that if I didn't mind, he would get me to take them back with me to London, as he should not be coming up for a day or two himself, and he did not think the cheeses ought to be kept much longer. "Oh, with pleasure, dear boy," I replied, "with pleasure." I called for the cheeses and took them away in a cab. It was a ramshackle affair, dragged along by a knock-kneed, broken-winded somnambulist, which his owner, in a moment of enthusiasm, during conversation, referred to as a horse. I put the cheeses on the top, and we started off at a shamble that would have done credit to the swiftest steamroller ever built. And all went merry as a funeral bell until we turned the corner. There, the wind carried a whiff from the cheeses full onto our steed. It woke him up, and with a snort of terror, he dashed off at 3 miles an hour. The wind still blew in his direction, and before we reached the end of the street, he was laying himself out at the rate of nearly 4 miles an hour, leaving the cripples and stout old ladies simply nowhere. It took 2 porters, as well as the driver, to hold him in at the station, and I do not think they would have done it even then, had not one of the men had the presence of mind to put a handkerchief over his nose and to light a bit of brown paper. I took my ticket and marched proudly up the platform with my cheeses, the people falling back respectfully on either side. The train was crowded, and I had to get into a carriage where there were already 7 other people. One crusty old gentleman objected, but I got in notwithstanding, and putting my cheeses upon the rack, squeezed down with a pleasant smile and said it was a warm day. A few moments passed, and then the old gentleman began to fidget. "Very close in here," he said. "Quite oppressive," said the man next to him. And then they both began sniffing, and at the 3rd sniff they caught it right in the chest and rose up without another word and went out. And then a stout lady got up and said it was disgraceful that a respectable married woman should be harried about in this way, and gathered up a bag and 8 parcels and went. The remaining 4 passengers sat on for a while until a solemn-looking man in the corner, who from his dress and general appearance seemed to belong to the undertaker class, said it put him in mind of a dead baby. And the other three passengers tried to get out the door at the same time and hurt themselves. I smiled at the black gentleman and said I thought we were going to have the carriage to ourselves. And he laughed pleasantly and said that some people made such a fuss over a little thing. But even he grew strangely depressed after we started. And so when we reached Crewe, I asked him to come and have a drink. He accepted, and we forced our way into the buffet, where we yelled and stamped and waved our umbrellas for a quarter of an hour, and then a young lady came and asked us if we wanted anything. "What's yours?" I said, turning to my friend. "I'll have half a crown's worth of brandy, if you please, miss," he responded. And he went off quietly after he had drunk it and got into another carriage, which I thought mean. So from Crewe I had the compartment to myself, though the train was crowded. As we drew up at the different stations, the people, seeing my empty carriage, would rush for it. "Here you are, Maria. Come along, plenty of room." "All right, Tom, we'll get in here," they would shout. And they would run along carrying heavy bags and fight around the door to get in first. And one would open the door and mount the steps and stagger back into the arms of the man behind him. And they would all come and have a sniff, and then droop off and squeeze into other carriages, or pay the difference and go first class. From Euston Station, I took the cheeses down to my friend's house. When his wife came into the room, she smelt around for an instant. Then she said, "What is it? Tell me the worst." I said, "It's cheeses. Tom bought them in Liverpool and asked me to bring them up with me." And I added that I hoped she understood that it had nothing to do with me. And she said that she was sure of that, but that she would speak to Tom about it when he came back. My friend was detained in Liverpool longer than he expected. And 3 days later, as he hadn't returned home, his wife called me. She said, "What did Tom say about those cheeses?" I replied that he had directed they were to be kept in a moist place and that nobody was to touch them. She said, "Nobody's likely to touch them." Had he smelt them? I thought he had, and added that he seemed greatly attached to them. "You think he would be upset," she asked, "if I gave a man a sovereign to take them away and bury them?" I answered that I thought he would never smile again. An idea struck her. She said, "Do you mind keeping them for him? Let me send them around to you." "Madam," I replied, "for myself, I like the smell of cheese. And the journey the other day with them from Liverpool, I shall ever look back upon as a happy ending to a pleasant holiday. But in this world, we must consider others. The lady under whose roof I have the honor of residing is a widow, and for all I know, possibly an orphan, too. She has a strong, I may say an eloquent, objection to being what she terms put upon. The presence of your husband's cheeses in her house, she would, I instinctively feel, regard as a put upon. And it shall never be said that I put upon the widow and the orphan." "Very well, then," said my wife's friend, rising. "All I have to say is that I shall take the children and go to a hotel until those cheeses are eaten. I decline to live any longer in the same house with them." She kept her word, leaving the place in charge of the charwoman, who, when asked if she could stand the smell, replied, "What smell?" And who, when taken close to the cheeses and told to sniff hard, said she could detect a faint odor of melons. It was argued from this that little injury could result to the woman from the atmosphere, and she was left. Okay, then one more section. About trying to get a hotel room, since I thought that many of you may have traveled on your way here and had to stay overnight and try to find a place to stay. And when we traveled out here, it was approaching the Labor Day weekend, and we were always a little bit worried about whether we could get a motel. Well, later in the story, one of the George asked the speaker if he remembered their first trip up the river when we landed at Datchet at 10 o'clock at night and wanted to go to bed, trying to find a place to stay at 10 p.m. I answered that I did remember it. It will be some time before I forget it. It was the Saturday before the August bank holiday. We were tired and hungry, we same three, and when we got to Datchet, we took out the hamper, the two bags, and the rugs and coats and such like things, and started off to look for diggings. We passed a very pretty little hotel with clematis and creeper over the porch, but there was no honeysuckle about it. And for some reason or other, I had got my mind fixed on honeysuckle. And I said, oh, don't let's go in there. Let's go on a bit farther and see if there isn't one with honeysuckle over it. So we went on till we came to another hotel. That was a very nice hotel, too. And it had honeysuckle on it, round at the side. But Harris did not like the look of a man who was leaning against the front door. He said he didn't look a nice man at all, and he wore ugly boots. So we went on farther. We went a goodish way without coming across any more hotels, and then we met a man and asked him to direct us to a few. He said, why, you are coming away from them. You must turn right around and go back, and then you will come to the Stag. We said, oh, we had been there and didn't like it. No honeysuckle over it. Well, then, he said, there's the manor house just opposite. Have you tried that? Harris replied that we did not want to go there. Didn't like the looks of a man who was staying there. Harris did not like the color of his hair. Didn't like his boots either. Well, I don't know what you'll do, I'm sure, said our informant, because they are the only two inns in the town. No other inns, exclaimed Harris. None, replied the man. What on earth are we to do? Cried Harris. Then George spoke up. He said Harris and I could get a hotel built for us if we liked, and have some people made to put in. For his part, he was going back to the Stag. The greatest minds never realize their ideals in any matter, and Harris and I sighed over the hollowness of all earthly desires and followed George. We took our traps into the Stag, laid them down in the hall. The landlord came up and said, good evening, gentlemen. Oh, good evening, said George. We want three beds, please. Very sorry, sir, said the landlord, but I'm afraid we can't manage it. Oh, well, never mind, said George. Two will do. Two of us can sleep in one bed, can't we? He continued, turning to Harris and me. Harris said, oh, yes. He thought George and I could sleep in one bed very easily. Very sorry, sir, again repeated the landlord, but we really haven't got a bed vacant in the whole house. In fact, we are putting two and even three gentlemen in one bed as it is. This staggered us for a bit. But Harris, who is an old traveler, rose to the occasion and laughing cheerily said, oh, well, we can't help it. We must rough it. You must give us a shakedown in the billiard room. Very sorry, sir. Three gentlemen sleeping on the billiard table already, and two in the coffee room. Can't possibly take you in tonight. We picked up our things and went over to the manor house. It was a pretty little place. I said I thought I should like it better than the other house, and Harris said, oh yes, it would be all right, and we needn't look at the man with the red hair. Besides, the poor fellow couldn't help having red hair. Harris spoke quite kindly and sensibly about it. The people at the manor house did not wait to hear us talk. The landlady met us on the doorstep with the greeting that we were the 14th party she had turned away within the last hour and a half. As for our meek suggestions of stables, billiard room, or coal cellars, she laughed them all to scorn. All these nooks had been snatched up long ago. Did she know of any place in the whole village where we could get shelter for the night? Well, if we didn't mind roughing it, she did not recommend it, mind, but there was a little beer shop half a mile down the Eaton Road. We waited to hear no more. We caught up the hamper and the bags and the coats and rugs and parcels and ran. The distance seemed more like a mile than half a mile, but we reached the place at last and rushed panting into the bar. The people at the beer shop were rude. They merely laughed at us. There were only three beds in the whole house. And they had 7 single gentlemen and 2 married couples sleeping there already. A kind-hearted bargeman, however, who happened to be in the tap room, thought we might try the grocer's next door to the Stag, and we went back. The grocer's was full. An old woman we met in the shop then kindly took us along with her for a quarter of a mile to a lady friend of hers who occasionally let rooms to gentlemen. This old woman walked very slowly, and we were 20 minutes getting to the lady friend. She enlivened the journey by describing to us as we trailed along the various pains she had in her back. Her lady friend's rooms were let. From there we were recommended to number 27. Number 27 was full, and sent us to number 32, and number 32 was full. Then we went back into the high road, and Harris sat down in the hamper and said he would go no farther. He said it seemed a quiet spot, and he would like to die there. He requested George and me to kiss his mother for him and to tell all his relations that he forgave them and died happy. At that moment, an angel came by in the disguise of a small boy, and I cannot think of any more effective disguise an angel could have assumed. With a can of beer in one hand, and in the other something at the end of a string, which he let down onto every flat stone he came across, and then pulled up again, thus producing a peculiarly unattractive sound, suggestive of suffering. We asked this heavenly messenger, as we discovered him afterwards to be, if he knew of any lonely house, whose occupants were few and feeble, old ladies or paralyzed gentlemen preferred, who could be easily frightened into giving up their beds for the night to 3 desperate men. Or if not this, could he recommend us to an empty pigsty, or a disused lime kiln, or anything of that sort? He did not know of any such place, at least not one handy. But he said that if we liked to come with him, his mother had a room to spare and could put us up for the night. We fell upon his neck there in the moonlight and blessed him. And it would have made a very beautiful picture if the boy himself had not been so overpowered by our emotion as to be unable to sustain himself under it and sunk to the ground, letting us all down on top of him. Harris was so overcome with joy that he fainted and had to seize the boy's beer can and half empty it before he could recover consciousness. And then he staggered off at a run and left George and me to bring on the luggage. It was a little 4-roomed cottage where the boy lived, and his mother, good soul, gave us hot bacon for supper, and we ate it all, 5 pounds, and a jam tart afterwards, and 2 pots of tea, and then we went to bed. There were 2 beds in the room. One was a 2-foot-6-inch truckle bed, and George and I slept in that. And kept in by tying ourselves together with a sheet. And the other was the little boy's bed. And Harris had that all to himself. And we found him in the morning with 2 feet of bare legs sticking out at the bottom. And George and I used it to hang the towels on while we bathed. I better read the opening of the Tin Can one. One more, a little bit briefer one here to finish with. One of the funniest scenes is any of us who've been camping is trying to open a can, if you've forgotten the can opener. We brightened up a bit, however, over the apple tart, which they had just eaten, and when George drew out a tin, that is the British word for a tin can, a tin of pineapple from the bottom of the hamper and rolled it into the middle of the boat, we felt that life was worth living after all. We are very fond of pineapple, all 3 of us. We looked at the picture on the tin. We thought of the juice. We smiled at one another, and Harris got a spoon ready. Then we looked for the knife to open the tin with. We turned out everything in the hamper. We turned out the bags. We pulled up the boards at the bottom of the boat. We took everything out onto the bank and shook it. There was no can opener to be found. Then Harris tried to open the tin with a pocket knife and broke the knife and cut himself badly. And George tried a pair of scissors, and the scissors flew up and nearly put his eye out. While they were dressing their wounds, I tried to make a hole in the thing with the spiky end of the hitcher. And the hitcher slipped and jerked me out between the boat and the bank into 2 feet of muddy water. And the tin rolled over, uninjured, and broke a teacup. Then we all got mad. We took that tin out on the bank, and Harris went up into a field and got a big, sharp stone. And I went back into the boat and brought out the mast. And George held the tin, and Harris held the sharp end of his stone against the top of it. And I took the mast and poised it high up in the air and gathered up all my strength and brought it down. It was George's straw hat that saved his life that day. He keeps that hat now, what is left of it. End of a winter's evening, when the pipes are lit and the boys are telling stretchers about the dangers they have passed through, George brings it down and shows it around, and the stirring tale is told anew, with fresh exaggerations every time. Harris got off with merely a flesh wound. After that, I took the tin off myself and hammered at it with the mast until I was worn out and sick at heart. Whereupon Harris took it in hand. We beat it out flat. We beat it back square. We battered it into every form known to geometry. But we could not make a hole in it. Then George went at it and knocked it into a shape so strange, so weird, so unearthly in its wild hideousness that he got frightened and threw away the mast. Then we all three sat around on the grass and looked at it. There was one great dent across the top that had the appearance of a mocking grin, and it drove us furious, so that Harris rushed at the thing and caught it up and flung it far into the middle of the river. And as it sank, we hurled our curses at it, and we got into the boat and rowed away from the spot and never paused till we reached the next town. Well, that's the way the whole thing goes. If you like that sense of humor, why, I recommend the book to you. I'll return this copy to the library, and you might be browsing in there and find it. And there are, I think, 3 copies of it still for sale in the bookstore if you want to take it with you. Well, you're good listeners, and I hope you enjoyed it. And
you did.